Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237 Teamsters. With us, a very special guest, Congressman Richie Torres, and that's Richie with a T. And I'm going to welcome him back to Reaching Out, but this is the first time in his capacity as a congressman. When he was here a few years ago, he was our councilman. Richie Torres is the congressman representing the 15th Congressional District of the Bronx. He was raised in public housing project along with his twin brother and sister by his mother, who worked minimum wage jobs, sometimes as low as $4.25 an hour. In 2013, at the age of 25, Richie was elected to the New York City Council, becoming New York City's youngest elected official and the first openly LGBTQ person elected to office in the Bronx. During his tenure at the City Council, he passed over 40 pieces of legislation, and as the committee chairman overseeing NYCHA, and then as NYCHA, as chairman of the Oversight and Investigations Committee, Richie held countless hearings and investigations that helped improve the lives of New York's most vulnerable populations. Today, Congressman Torres continues this work as a member of the Committee on Financial Services and the House Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party. Congressman Richie Torres, welcome back to Reaching Out. Thank you for appearing.
Always an honor to be here.
Thank you. So you grew up in public housing, as we mentioned, in the Bronx. Could you tell us how a childhood in public housing eventually led you to become a member of Congress?
Well, I never thought that life would take me on a journey from public housing in the Bronx to the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. I was born and raised in the Bronx. I spent almost all my life in poverty. I was raised by a single mother who had to raise three children on minimum wage, which in the 1990s was $4.25 an hour. In fact, when I won my congressional primary in June of 2020, when I knew that I was going to enter the House of Representatives, I publicly said that before I was a congressman or a councilman, I'm first and foremost the son of my mother, Deborah Bosselet. And I consider it the high honor of my life to represent the Bronx, which is full of powerful mothers who have struggled and sacrificed and suffered so that their children and grandchildren can have a fighting chance at the American dream. As you know, I spent most of my life in public housing, and public housing has been so chronically underfunded in New York City that there were families like mine who lived in conditions of mold and mildew, leaks and lead, without consistent heat and hot water in the winter. I tell people that my life is something of a metaphor because I grew up in the Rock's Neck Houses, which was right across the street from Trump Golf Course. And as the golf course was undergoing construction, I kid you not, it unleashed a skunk infestation. So I tell people I've been smelling the stench of Donald Trump well before he became president. But as I saw the conditions in my home get worse every day, the city had invested $100 million to construct a golf course for Donald Trump. And I remember asking myself at the time, what does it say about our society that we're willing to put more money into a golf course than into the homes of poor people in public housing? And so I got my start in politics as a housing organizer. And then eventually at age 24, I took the leap of faith and ran for public office. I had no ties to the party machine. I had no deep pockets. I was essentially a housing organizer. You were one of the few people to support me when I first ran. And I spent a whole year doing nothing but knocking on doors. I went into people's homes. I heard their stories. And I won my first campaign on the strength of door-to-door, face-to-face campaigning. I became the youngest elected official in America's largest city. What's unusual about my story is that 7 years before then, I was at the lowest point of my life. I had dropped out of college. I found myself struggling with depression, abusing substances. There were moments when I thought of taking my own life because I felt as if the world around me had collapsed. I felt a profound sense of failure. And I never thought 7 years later, I would become the youngest elected official in America's largest city. And then 7 years later, become a member of the United States Congress. And so I tell people, even in your moment of greatest hardship, never lose hope.
That's an incredible, incredible opening, incredible story. And I heard something for the very first time. I want to ask you about that. A lot of us don't know, but are you telling us that the golf course that Donald Trump has his name on it was paid for with city funds?
My understanding is that the city spent over $100 million to remediate the land, Ferry Point Park, in order to pave the way for the construction of the golf course, which was ultimately named after Donald Trump. And so more city resources were put into a golf course than into public housing.
That's just shocking. I'm hearing this for the first time. Breaking news on Reaching Out. We're hearing for the first time the city spent $100 million to get land ready so that Donald Trump can build a golf course. And by the way, I can see that golf course every time I go over the Dog's Neck Bridge, and it's a golf course that I've never been on. I won't go over there, but there are better courses that I've seen. Clearview Express, Clearview Golf Course, better golf courses. It looks like a golf course that you would see in the desert. And I've been in the desert and saw a golf course that looked better than that one. So, and that's not to say because of who it is named after. It's just a fact. It's just not a good golf course.
You know, when I was living in public housing in Bronx Neck, there was a conspiracy theory that Donald Trump had bought public housing, or he was going to buy public housing. And there's a sense in which the conspiracy theory became true, that when Donald Trump became president, he effectively became the owner of public housing because the federal government is the primary funder and regulator of public housing. And public housing suffered under his presidency.
Yes, that is a fact. You are a young man of color and a member of the LGBTQ committee. What have been some of your experiences in Congress in Washington, D.C.?
Look, I tell people that I do not fit into the typical profile of a member of Congress, but I don't have a net worth of $1 million. I don't come from a political family. I don't even have a college degree. But what I lack in traditional qualifications, I make up for in lived experience. You know, I know what it's like to face housing insecurity and food insecurity. I know what it's like to face poverty and inequality. I know what it's like to have family members entangled with the criminal justice system. I know what it's like to struggle with depression and substance abuse. And so I am a product of my lived experiences. My lived experiences inform how I approach governing. And so I feel like I bring a radically different perspective to the United States Congress. People like me have historically been underrepresented in the halls of the United States Congress.
You are one of the only members and few members of Congress who openly talk about mental health and your own struggles. What can be done to help with mental health issues and remove the stigma associated with them?
Well, we're living in a time when the subject of mental health has taken on new urgency. You know, I would submit to you that social media and COVID-19 have been catastrophes for the mental health of our society. I'm no stranger to mental illness. Every morning I take the same antidepressant that I've taken for more than a decade, and I feel no shame in admitting it because it enables me to be the best version of myself, to function both as a productive person and a productive public servant. And I would not be alive today. I would not be in the United States Congress were it not for mental health care and the stability it gave me and my family. And so I feel a deep sense of obligation to share my story of overcoming mental illness in order to break the silence and stigma and shame that so often surrounds the subject of mental health. You know, there is power in telling your story. Right? Telling your story can play a role in raising awareness and inspiring others to do the same.
Now, I just left a meeting where mental health was brought up. It was brought up in the subway station in New York City. It's brought up on the streets, and there's reports of recidivism with, I would say, people committing crimes being rearrested. And it's a small percentage of people who are going through this revolving door. And every time you look, turn around, it's the same person being rearrested. And some of them, most of them, have mental health issues. And if we're able to solve or even stem the mental health issues where we just take the stigma away and just, and I won't say force people, but as needed, put people in treatment centers, because you do that, I believe we lessen the crime and the dangers to our society, because unchecked, people with mental illness do not get better. And the advocates saying, no, don't force them into something. It's either you do that or they commit crimes. And when they commit crimes on society. And it's more expensive when they commit crimes than if we just go for the treatment. And I have a saying, I say it all the time. You could pay now or you could pay more later.
I agree with you. There's no set of people whom we are failing more miserably as a society than the severely mentally ill, who are often left to languish on the streets, on the subways, in our jails and prisons. There's no greater indictment of our society than the fact that Rikers Island has become the largest provider of mental health care in the country. And, you know, we as a society have to recognize that we have swung the pendulum too far in the direction of deinstitutionalization. And we have to recognize that there are people who are so, whose mental illness is so severe that it requires inpatient care. Because yes. Without inpatient care, you're condemning those people either to the streets or the subways or worse, jails and prison. And yes. Jails and prison will cause more mental illness than it prevents.
That's right.
So I'm in favor of a policy known as the IMD exclusion. So it's not widely known, but the law that established Medicare and Medicaid included something known as the IMD exclusion, which restricts federal funding for inpatient mental health hospitals. It has led to a severe shortage of psychiatric beds, not only in New York City, but across the country. And so I feel strongly that we should repeal the IMD exclusion and reopen psychiatric hospitals so that those who need psychiatric care can finally receive it. That's the only way forward.
Yeah, a lot of people, and especially in New York State, don't realize when the state closed a lot of its hospitals, Creedmoor, Pilgrim State, they're just empty buildings. Not only were people put out of work, but people were put out of healthcare. You didn't have the population of homeless and mental health crisis that we have now, and people being attacked by people who, for no better word, don't know any better because they're sick and they need help and they need inpatient treatment, because when they made them outpatients, they weren't getting the care and medication that they need. And it's saved on taxes, but that's not paying now, but it's created a whole lot of problems with crime and homelessness and everything else that we're paying more for, and it's later. So you can pay now or you can pay more later. We're paying more later, and we continue to pay more later. And people would be amazed at how fast society can turn around if we just let people get treatment, the treatment that they needed, as needed.
I agree with you. No, we need to rethink how we approach mental health care for the severely mentally ill. When you're shutting down psychiatric hospitals, you're not reducing the amount of mentally ill people in our society. You're simply going to relocate those people to prisons and jails. What's happening.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, deinstitutionalization is a myth. We're not deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill. We're reinstitutionalizing them in places like Rikers Island.
Yeah. Or the homeless camps and shelters and everything else. And
shelter
committing
system.
Crimes and they're preying on people, and crime is going up and people are just trying to hide from the mentally ill by moving out of cities that was once vibrant. You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237 Teamsters. With me, our very special guest, Congressman Richie Torres. And I always say, I like to say with a T, because he points that out, Richie, with a T. Fire safety has been the hallmark of your work in Congress. One of the deadliest fires in New York City history occurred in your district, Twin Parks, and lithium iron battery fires continue to plague New York City. What legislation are you working on to help make our city safer from these deadly fires?
Well, there's no place that has a greater stake in fire safety than the Bronx. In the past 30 years, the four deadliest fires in New York City history were all in the Bronx. And lithium ion batteries have emerged as one of the leading causes of fires. You know, from 2019 to 2022, 2023, we've seen a 900% surge in the number of lithium ion battery fires.
900%,
which is staggering. We're facing an unprecedented crisis in fire safety. In 2019, there were more than 30 fatalities from lithium ion battery fires. In 2020, there were more than 40. In 2021, more than 100. In 2022, more than 200. And so it's growing at a pace that we've never seen before. And the city council has passed legislation, but local legislation could only take you so far because these lithium ion batteries cross state lines and are largely coming from China and are poorly manufactured. We're literally importing ticking time bombs. A poorly manufactured lithium ion battery is a ticking time bomb that will cause not just a fire, but an explosion. And so I introduced legislation that would empower the Consumer Product Safety Commission to set mandatory safety standards for the manufacturing of lithium-ion batteries and the e-mobilities, the e-bikes that contain them. And I'm convinced that more safely manufactured lithium-ion batteries will radically reduce the number of fires that we've seen in New York City and elsewhere in the country. It's a matter of saving lives.
A new report has shown that many families are leaving New York City due to the high cost of childcare. You have introduced the Child Act. What does the Child Act do?
So, look, in New York City, we are facing a crisis of childcare affordability. Families in New York City. So according to the federal government, a family should spend no more than 7% of their income on childcare. Families in New York City are spending a quarter of their income on childcare. Families in the Bronx are spending almost half of their income on childcare, the highest of any county in the country, according to the Department of Labor. The Five Borough Institute came out with a report which found that 80% of New Yorkers cannot afford childcare. And so childcare is pricing out New Yorkers out of their own homes and communities. It's creating barriers to gender equality, right? There are women who have had to withdraw from the workforce, who have had to delay their career advancement because of the crushing cost of childcare. And so I see it as an issue of affordability and an issue of gender equality. And so I'm part of a bipartisan coalition advancing the Child Act. It's the Combating High Inflation in Daycare Act. And the Child Act would double federal funding for child care assistance through a program known as the Dependent Care Assistance Program, FSA's Flexibility Savings Accounts, which are simply free tax savings accounts for child care. The cap on those savings accounts is $5,000 and has been $5,000 since 1986. The cap has not been lifted since 1986. Federal funding for childcare has been lagging inflation for 40 years. And so the Child Act would not only double the cap from $5,000 to $10,000, but it would ensure that the cap is indexed to inflation, that it keeps pace with the rising cost of living in New York City. You know, we as a society have to ask ourselves, is childcare a right that belongs to all of us? Or is it a privilege reserved only for those who can afford it? And if you believe that childcare is a right, then you should support the Child Act.
Well, How about this? What's ironic in our country? You have the courts banning abortions, harsh abortions. You have states trying to take away abortion rights. But therefore, that's on one hand. Now, when you have a child, oh, you're on your own. We don't want to help you take care of that child. We don't want to feed that child. We don't want to do anything for families with children. But yet we want to ban abortion. So you want to do more for children who are not here yet than you want to do for children who are here. What's the irony in that?
Are you suggesting that Republicans are not pro-life from birth to death? Is that
I'm really pointing out the facts. The facts are they want to ban abortions. The facts are they don't want to help you take care of children. They should be all behind the Child Care Act. You know what? Maybe people on their own would want to have more children if they could afford to take care of the children. How about that?
Look, we have a vested interest in building a society that is affordable to families. There is nothing more destructive to our economy and our society than a collapse in the birth rate.
Yeah.
You know, you have a country like China that's facing a demographic crisis so severe that the population is going to collapse by the end of the century in half. And what, you know, what sustains the U.S. economy is our high birth rates that come largely from immigrants.
This is something, and you know, again, I got to say, you want to take care of children who are not yet here. It seems like they care more about what could happen than what's happening. I was supposed to ask you about NYCHA, the recent experiment. We have about a minute and a half of no bid contracts and what you think should be done. And you take a minute, I give you 30 seconds because what should be done was ignored.
Well, as you know, I held a hearing on no bid contracting back when I was in the city council in 2019. DOI conducted multiple investigations. You've been sounding the alarm.
Yes.
So NYCHA knew the problem.
Yes, they
NYCHA
did.
Was aware of the recommendations that we made, and NYCHA ignored them.
That's correct.
And the end result was the largest bribery takedown in the history of DOJ.
Yeah.
So these are self-inflicted problems, but yeah. NYCHA needs to bring more transparency and accountability to these no-bid contracts. Wherever you have no-bid contracting, whether it's the public sector or private sector, whether it's NYCHA or any other agency, you're going to have a potential for corruption. And so you need to ensure that those contracts are subject to the right amount of transparency and accountability.
Yeah, you had the hearing. Yes, I remember the hearing. I remember the recommendations. I agreed with the recommendations because I knew better. Why would I set people up for failure? I wouldn't do it. We have about 30 seconds. In 30 seconds, is there a message that you want to give us before we say that time is up, and we always ask you to come back?
Well, I just want to thank you for your friendship. I mean, you've been a supporter of mine from day one. You believed in me when most people never thought I had a chance of winning my council seat and then my congressional seat. And I just want to thank the employees you represent who are sustaining public housing, which to me is the greatest safety net of affordable housing in our country. And it needs to be preserved for the next generation.
You're welcome. And I want to thank you for making us proud that we can say we endorse you as a council member and we endorse you as a congressman. And we didn't hesitate on that endorsement because
you did not hesitate.
You did such a great job as a councilman. I said, you are the right person, the right time, and you're young enough to really make a difference. And as I told you, I will retire and admire you and your good work. And I thank you because you're about 25 years younger than me, so it's inevitable that I'm going to leave you in the workplace to continue on and do your good work. And I thank you for representing the people of your district and representing New York well.
Absolutely. Thank you for your friendship. Take care.
This has been Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237 Teamsters. With us, a very special guest was Richie Torres, Congressman from the Bronx.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, President of Teamsters Local 237.